To what extent did the press, the so-called yellow press of the time, have in the conviction of Leo Frank?
The press in Atlanta was out of control during the Frank case, and it was largely egged on by a now-defunct daily paper, the Atlanta Georgian, which had been purchased a year before the Frank case by William Randolph Hearst. And William Randolph Hearst, the great press baron, really the man for whom the term yellow journalism was coined, imported a lot of hardened news professionals from New York and Chicago, and they were sitting around Atlanta bored out of their minds. And the story comes across that a 13-year-old child laborer has been found murdered in a child labor factory, and the Atlanta Georgian ran wild with this story. Multiple extras every day, screaming headlines, red banners atop the paper, and one of the Georgian reporters said that the coverage was so aggressive that it essentially sounded a death knell for the Constitution and the Journal, which initially tried to approach the story much more discreetly, but that wasn't going to work, so very rapidly they began competing with the Georgian, and you had a frenzy of three daily papers hotly following the story, and it's really one of the first great, if not the first great, American media frenzy. And by the time Frank went on trial, the city was overwrought, and crowds, some days by the thousands, stood outside the courthouse trying to get in to bear witness to the trial.
And I think because of that media frenzy, it's been pointed out that Leo Frank and Mary Fagan actually became symbols. Frank was painted as the carpetbagger who was Jewish from up north, and she was the flower of innocent southern womanhood.
Yes, they really were emblematic more than they were human. I mean, Mary Fagan's life was cut off so short that the world never got to know her. She died a 13-year-old child, and we know very little about her. Frank also died very young. We know a bit more about him, but the media seized on these two, and I will say, initially, it was just pure sensationalism. There was no real editorial bias in the three Atlanta newspapers. They just played the case for its pure circulation value. So they played up sex and drama, and it was a sexy case. There were rumors and innuendo that the National Pencil Company, which stood for the Sam Nunn Federal Building is now on Forsyth Street, that this big old factory was a hotbed of sexual liaison, and that girls would be seduced there. The setup encouraged it in that it was a sweatshop where most of the 100-plus labor force was composed of adolescent girls. And so here was a workforce of pubescent, beautiful southern girls and a management force led by a Cornell-educated Jew with a degree in industrial engineering. And so there was, you know, a tinderbox of class and sexual tension in that building, and the Hearst newspaper especially just ran wild with it.
The jury's guilty verdict largely ignored facts in the case, you think?
No, I think there was a reasonable case against Leo Frank. The other thing that makes the case so notable in its early stage is that Frank was convicted primarily on the testimony of a black pencil factory sweeper named Jim Conley, and Jim Conley was Frank's confessed accomplice. Conley said he had stood guard for Frank while Frank attempted to seduce Mary Fagan, and that something went wrong and Frank accidentally killed Mary Fagan and then recruited Conley to help dispose of the body. And Conley told this story to the police in four contradictory affidavits, and then he testified for 3 days against Leo Frank. And this was at the trial. And at the trial, Frank's high-priced lawyers really couldn't break Conley down. Conley answered many questions by saying he had faulty memory, he'd forgotten, but he never seriously contradicted himself on a main point. And so the jury heard the all-white jury heard a black witness accuse the Ivy League-educated industrialist of murdering this young girl who'd refused his sexual advances, and the white jury believed the black witness. And that's one of the first times in a capital case in the South a murder conviction was returned by a white jury based on a black witness's testimony against a white man. And that was shocking, and the testimony of Conley was compelling. It was mesmerizing, and when you read it, you're hard-pressed to see the holes in it, at least on first reading.
This case has appealed to the Georgia Supreme Court and then the U.S. Supreme Court more than once, a couple of times. There's lots of appeals in this case, right?
Yes, the appeals went on for a year and a half, and Frank lost every appeal. And the appeals were largely on matters of law, although by the time the case got to the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, a very serious issue had been raised. The hostility against Frank was so great at the trial that his lawyers, at the suggestion of the presiding judge, agreed that Frank would not be in the courtroom on the day the jury returned its verdict because the judge feared that if Frank was acquitted, he would be lynched. So Frank's defense lawyers in the appellate procedure felt that this proved there was a hostile atmosphere for the trial, and that Frank could appeal on the 14th Amendment, that he had not received due process. And later that would become law, but this was a very innovative approach in 1915, and the U.S. Supreme Court turned him down 7-2 with a very eloquent dissent by Oliver Wendell Holmes.
So his death sentence stands. He's sent to prison in Milledgeville, and then the governor, Governor Slayton, commutes his sentence right before the governor leaves office to life. And as many people are familiar with the story, a number of people basically broke into the prison, kidnapped Frank, brought him back to Marietta, and lynched him. They hanged him. No one was ever convicted of that lynching. It sort of brings to mind what happened at Moore's Ford in Walton County in 1946. You've got, I'm sure you're familiar with, four blacks are shot down in broad daylight with as many as 20 participants, and nothing ever comes of it.
Yes, the Moore's Ford case really is sort of at the end of this period of extra-legal violence that marked Georgia for 50-odd years. The Frank case is a little different in that by this point, Frank was probably the most celebrated prisoner in the United States. The case had become a nationwide cause célèbre with newsreel coverage and movie stars coming to Atlanta to support Leo Frank and front-page news stories in every paper in the nation. And the group that lynched Frank not only went against this popular sentiment out in the land, but they invaded a state prison. The state prison was then in Milledgeville, and abducted Leo Frank, not from a county jail or not out in broad daylight as occurred at Moore's Ford, but from the holding of the state. And then they drove Frank across multiple jurisdictions on largely unpaved roads in the dead of night and some 150 miles because they took a very circuitous route that steered around Atlanta, and they lynched him at dawn the next day. So essentially the men who lynched Leo Frank just spit in the eye of the authorities of the state of Georgia, and indeed they succeeded. None was ever convicted. None was ever indicted. It was a perfect crime. And a number of extremely powerful people in Marietta decided that they were not going to let Governor Slayton commute Frank's sentence, and they ordained that Frank would be lynched, and they organized this exceptionally bold mission that broke into the state prison and brought Frank halfway across the state and hanged him the next day.
Following the lynching, the Ku Klux Klan undergoes its revival, I guess in part because of the Frank case, but also because of the Birth of a Nation, the Birth of a Nation movie that came out. And on the other side, the Anti-Defamation League is formed, but still the message for Atlanta's Jewish community was pretty clear after the Frank case, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Atlanta Jewish community in the aftermath of Leo Frank's lynching really lapsed into a long period of repression and denial, and the rabbi at the main Reform synagogue, the temple, Dr. Marx, he began to eschew some of the Jewish ritual. He no longer used a chuppah at weddings, and you know, there was just a quiet and paranoid quality to life for Atlanta's Jews in the aftermath of Leo Frank's lynching. And, you know, it went on for quite a long time. When I researched my book, I had an easier time getting family members whose parents or grandparents had participated in the lynching to talk to me than I did having family members of Leo Frank or Leo Frank's relatives talk to me. And what really pounded the point home for me is that I got to know quite well Leo Frank's nephew, who told me that when Leo Frank's widow, Lucille, died in the late 1950s, she was cremated and he kept her ashes. And when it came time to bury those ashes out in Oakland Cemetery, he was afraid of calling public attention to the Frank case by having a public burial. So he and his brother buried Lucille Frank's ashes in a private ceremony with garden tools in an unmarked plot in Oakland Cemetery. And when this was Harold Marcus, Lucille and Leo Frank's nephew, when Harold told me this, I realized, you know, that encapsulates the fear and repression of Atlanta's Jewish community, that even 50-some years after the lynching, when the widow of Leo Frank dies, the family is still too anxious to have a public burial. I thought it was very profound and very telling.
The Leo Frank case was revived in the early 1980s when the Nashville paper, the Tennessean, revisits the case based on the testimony from Alonzo Mann, who Leo Frank's assistant at the factory, who claimed he saw Jim Conley, the janitor, carrying Mary Fagan's body. Now, that surfaced in the 1980s, but is it true that Mann originally pitched his story to the Atlanta Constitution in the 1950s?
There were always rumors that Alonzo Mann had tried to sell the Atlanta papers on his story and that the Atlanta papers didn't bite. You know, some people said that Alonzo Mann was unreliable and that's why they didn't take the story. I'm not certain. I mean, the Atlanta papers over the years between Leo Frank's lynching and the Nashville Tennessean's story about Alonzo Mann did do several pieces, you know, looking at the Frank case again. But, you know, Alonzo Mann's was dramatic and shocking because Alonzo said that he had been in the factory the day of the murder. He had left the building around noon. He forgot something. He got a couple blocks away from the building, ran back to the building, burst through the lobby doors, and saw Jim Conley in the lobby holding Mary Fagan's body. And that Jim Conley told Alonzo, "You better keep quiet. If you say anything, I'll kill you." And Alonzo was a shy, stuttering 14-year-old boy, and soon thereafter, Atlanta was completely overwrought because of the news reports of Mary Fagan's murder, and Alonzo kept quiet as a consequence. I did the last interview with Alonzo in a Veterans Administration hospital up in Tennessee, and that's actually how I got interested in the Frank case. I wrote a story for Esquire magazine based on Alonzo's late in life revelations, and you know, they were powerfully dramatic, and I believed Alonzo. I think he saw what he said he saw. For real students of the Frank case, it didn't add that much because, you know, even those who think that Leo Frank was guilty say that Jim Conley carried the body after Frank enlisted him as his aide to the basement where the body was finally found. The key thing about Alonzo's story is Conley testified that he was in the elevator in the factory when he took it to the basement. If what Alonzo said was true, Conley was in the lobby, which means he didn't use the elevator, which means that Conley lied about this salient detail.
Hmm. Well, the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles issues a pardon of sorts for Leo Frank in the mid-80s, but it's not, it doesn't really say he's innocent. It doesn't say he's not guilty.
No, the state of Georgia essentially apologized to Leo Frank for not protecting his constitutional rights. The state of Georgia essentially said, "We're sorry, the prison was like a sieve, the lynch party got in, and Leo Frank was denied his due process, his constitutional right to continue to defend himself." And, you know, that may seem like a half-hearted measure, but after having spent a number of years looking through all the voluminous material and newspaper accounts and legal documents related to the Frank case, I think that's probably all the Pardon and Parole Board could do. You can't reverse a conviction, an 80-year-old conviction at that point, based on the wavery memory of an 85-year-old man. Much of the evidence has, the physical evidence has disappeared. It's, you know, very, very hard to retry a case when, you know, all the material that would allow you to make true judgments is gone. So I think that was a fair compromise, and the Pardon and Parole Board did the best that it could.
Is it possible that a DNA connection could be made between Frank and Fagan, or Jim Connolly and Fagan? Is it possible now to do that, do you think? Should the bodies be exhumed?
It's possible, but first and foremost, we don't know where Jim Connolly is. There's no death certificate for Jim Connolly at the State Department of Archives. There's no reliable report as to even when he died. So we won't be able to find anything on Jim Connolly until someone comes forward to say where he was interred and where he perished. You know, there were all sorts of dark rumors about the case. There were rumors that Mary Fagan's body was mutilated, that her body was covered with bite wounds. You know, the press, in part, sensational as it was very prim in 1913. Even such a word as rape was, you know, too brutal to be used in a daily newspaper. So you had to read between the lines of the accounts to try to determine exactly what happened to Mary Fagan. And complicating it even more, there was no autopsy of Mary Fagan until 9 days after her death. And that sounds unbelievable in contemporary world. But at that time, when you start to research other criminal cases, you realize that autopsies were not de rigueur. And so Mary Fagan was given what was called a field autopsy next to her grave out at the Marietta City Cemetery. And 9 days after the murder and following embalmment, you know, what exactly the doctors determined, other than removing some contents from her stomach, which allowed them to ascertain roughly the time of her death because of the state of digestion. Beyond that, everything was pretty much guesswork.
The rabid anti-Semitism displayed by some in the community, including you know, Tom Watson, the editor of the Jeffersonian, really whipped up a lot of sentiment against Leo Frank. In a recent Atlanta Magazine essay, you posed the question, could that happen again, like nowadays? Could it?
I think something similar could happen. I think, you know, we're at a very polarized period in American politics, red state versus blue state. Every single court decision or election is debated not so much on the merits of the decision or the race, but on deeper societal or cultural issues that you know, these contests supposedly embody. So I could see something very much like the Frank case happening again. One difference, though, is there was essentially no Federal Bureau of Investigation in 1915. So once Leo Frank was lynched and the grand jury in Cobb County returned a no bill, which meant that they couldn't determine who lynched him, the case was over. Today, there'd be some sort of federal statute where the Department of Justice would come after a lynch party. So that's a huge thing. And also, I think we're much more distracted today than we were in 1915. In 1915, while Atlanta was a big city, it was a compact and relatively homogenous big city where an event like the Mary Fagan murder and Leo Frank lynching captured everyone's attention. Today, we're distracted, and after a certain point, those crimes, hideous as they are, would just be other pieces of news, and the caravan would move on, which is both good and bad.
What about the role of social media today? I mean, in a way, you could say that because of Twitter and Facebook and blogs, there could be lots of Tom Watsons out there.
There are lots of Tom Watsons out there, and there was a story in the Jewish Daily Forward a couple of weeks ago about the anniversary of the Frank case. That's the New York Jewish paper, and the story broke some news I knew nothing about, that a number of websites concerning the Leo Frank case are apparently backed by former official of the American Nazi Party. And so you go to one of these websites thinking you're going to find some independent and vetted information about the Leo Frank case, and instead you're getting very well-packaged anti-Semitism. And, you know, the web is a... As flawed as the American press is, and as flawed as the press was in the Leo Frank case, I'm a huge believer in it because I don't think we've improved on it. And the reason I believe in it is that you read something in a good newspaper, and it's vetted, it's edited. The reporter has had to answer to, you know, a number of standards that are tried and true. And you read something on a blog, it's just one person's opinion, or on a website. Yeah, some of these people are brilliant, some of them are very, very imaginative, but there's not a standard of accuracy applied that gives me much faith that this is all true. So yeah, you could have a demagogue holding forth online and whipping people up, and I think that's a real danger.
So 100 years after the Leo Frank trial, the case is pretty much wrapped up, isn't it? I mean, his guilt or innocence could never really be proven nowadays. It's basically over, although people will still discuss it, won't they?
I think people will still discuss it for a number of reasons. One, the polarizing impact of a crime that led to the formation of both the Anti-Defamation League and the Ku Klux Klan, or to be accurate, it galvanized the ADL. The ADL had been founded in 1913. So you've got these two, you know, groups, one for good, one for bad, still with us, and the Frank case is involved in the DNA of both of them. And then secondly, I think the lynching was just so audacious. There were 22 lynchings in Georgia in 1915. In fact, a black man named Riggins down in South Georgia was lynched the same day as Leo Frank, so you can't overlook that. But the Frank lynching was an assault on a state institution. A state prison was invaded by a group, and a star inmate was abducted, and they got away with it. And I think that will continue to be a source of fascination, because it's a dark mystery of derring do, and appalling as it is, you have to stand back and just marvel that these guys pulled it off.
Steve Oney is an essayist and author of the definitive book on the Leo Frank case and The Dead Shall Rise. Mr. Oney, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Steve, very much.